This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we've arrived at that threshold of the next phase of the Affordable Care Act. Online insurance exchanges are open for business this week.
That's right, Mark. And now consumers will be able to shop for that affordable health insurance in these new online marketplaces. And it ushers in a new era. Folks cannot be denied coverage due to pre-existing conditions. And that's a provision that will strike at the heart of the fears of millions of Americans who've grappled with health problems and a lack of coverage. A really big step forward, I think.
While this is notable and important new development, we can't ignore the disparity that still exists across the country. Only 16 states in the District of Columbia are setting up their own insurance exchanges, and in many states, state governments are working hard to block any assistance in accessing the federal exchanges.
Analysts are finding that folks in states who have promoted the health care law are better informed and more likely to utilize the health insurance exchanges.
Coverage doesn't actually begin until January 1st, 2014, but if folks are interested in getting coverage on the first day of the new year, you'll have to sign up on the exchanges.
But Mark, Medicaid expansion is another important aspect to this increased coverage that we've talked about a lot on our show. More states are expanding Medicaid coverage, and at last count, I think we are up to 26 states, which bodes well for those folks who live above the poverty line in those states. It's going to help alleviate disparities in access to care, and that is something that today's guest has made his life's work.
Our guest this week is Dr. H. Jack Geiger, who's considered the founder of the community health center movement in this country, having opened up the first community health centers in the 1960s. He's not only a physician, but a lifelong activist for health equity as well.
And Dr. Geiger is an inspiration to so many of us who've worked in the field of healthcare and in community health centers over these last decades, Mark. So we really look forward to that conversation.
We do. And we also are going to have a visit from Laurie Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org. She'll dispel another myth about Obamacare.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you.
And we'll get to our interview with Dr. H. Jack Geiger in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Efforts to defund Obamacare have continued right up to the October 1st start of the open enrollment of the online insurance marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act. But conservative ranks of the GOP, looking at a last-ditch effort to stop the healthcare law in its tracks, sought to attach the defunding measure to a must-pass bill to keep the government going past the end of the fiscal year, the so-called continuing resolution to keep government running until December 15th. Meanwhile, a series of ad campaigns have been launched across the country, both for and against the healthcare law, some ads urging folks to get covered using iconic songs like Billy Joel's New York State of Mind, only in this case it's New York State of Health. A Virginia-based conservative group backed by the billionaire Koch brothers launched their own campaign urging young people to opt out of the law's mandate that all Americans have health insurance. Their first online ads feature young people going for doctor appointments only to have creepy Uncle Sam pop up, ready to look them over. The Obama administration set the stage for another Supreme Court showdown on the president's health care law, this time to decide whether for-profit companies can be forced to provide full contraceptive coverage for their employees despite religious objections from owners. The administration's lawyers asked justices to take up the issue this fall to decide whether these corporations can claim a religious exemption to this part of the health care law. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these health care headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. H. Jack Geiger, physician founding member of Physicians for Human Rights and Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the individual acknowledges the father of the community health center movement in the United States. Dr. Geiger is currently professor emeritus at the Sophie Davis School of Biomedical Education in New York City. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine, where he received IOM's most prestigious award, the Leinhardt Award for Outstanding Contributions to Minority Minority Health, and also was awarded the Schweitzer Prize for Humanitarianism. Dr. Geiger, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, Jack, you're known as the father of the community health center movement in this country, a model you proposed in 1965 based on your experience as a young American medical student studying this sort of new kind of healthcare, which was called community-oriented primary care in South Africa. What was that new kind of healthcare that you saw, and how did it influence the proposals you would later make for the development of the first community health center in America?
Well, I think the most striking thing was the assumption of dual responsibility. That is, that this institution, these community health centers, were responsible not just one by one, but equally for the health of the population from which they came, ending the long-standing separation between primary care and public health. When I worked in the examining rooms in South Africa, on the walls of every examining room were graphs, histograms of the latest information on the prevalent conditions in that community, incidence rates for infectious disease and the like. You could not look at an individual patient without knowing a lot about the population from which that person came and responsibility for doing something about it to keep the next patient from coming in with that same problem.
Jack, the seeds of the American Community Health Center movement, the two community health centers, really quite quickly grew. Today, of course, all across the country, we have more than 1,100 community health centers that serve 20 million people. But I find it kind of remarkable that the fundamental requirements for an organization to be recognized by the federal government as a community health center remain remarkably true to your original vision and those principles of community-oriented primary care nearly 50 years later. Can you describe some of those principles and requirements for us that you found essential to be in the guidance that would govern community health centers in the U.S.?
The first was the idea that the most vulnerable populations in the United States, the people in greatest need and with the heaviest burdens of disease, needed something other than the fragmented, primarily hospital-centered care. We did a survey at Columbia Point in Boston, for example, to find out what it took for a patient at Columbia Point to get to downtown Boston, go to an outpatient department clinic, and come back home. The average door-to-door time for a patient at Columbia Point to go get care in Boston and come back home was 6 hours. And what did you do if you had three small kids? And what did you do if one of the children had asthma and that was a different clinic that you had to go to the next day? So the first principle was of comprehensiveness, to put everything under one roof, to create, and when I say everything under one roof, I mean physician, nurse, social worker, pharmacy, laboratory, all of the pieces that required you to run around frantically if you were of limited means. And the second was the principle of community participation and ultimately community control of what was now a community institution that belonged to the population that was being served. There's no other branch of the American healthcare system in which the patients themselves have that kind of voice in the services that they're going to receive with regard to healthcare.
You know, Dr. Geiger, your work is about understanding and addressing what is now called the social determinants of health. And that's been sort of at the heart of the community health center movement. And you are now sort of looking at the Affordable Care Act and its principles of patient-centered medical home. And tell us how you see Obamacare addressing population health.
Well, I think Obamacare is a first, modest, but enormously important step from moving us away from very, very costly, very inefficient distribution and practice of care, away from a fee-for-service emphasis and on outcomes, at least the process of controlling costs of what has become such an outrageously expensive and inefficient system that it bankrupts individuals and threatens to bankrupt the country. The health of populations is determined by the very things you mentioned, mm-hmm. The social determinants of health. what you're exposed to, what happens to out in the real world, whether urban or rural, your income, your housing, your food. What Obamacare will do is, number one, greatly improve the quality and availability of primary care. Insurance alone doesn't do it, but it's critical in providing access to care, and thus bringing somewhere between 30 and 40 million more people with that kind of regular access, and providing what I've just described, a patient-centered medical home with an emphasis on the goodness of the outcome. It gives us the opportunity to start addressing the social determinants of health, but we need to understand that unless we create greater equality in the society, no single healthcare system is by itself going to suffice to produce healthy quality. There is a whole series of studies demonstrating that adversity and poverty in early childhood starts measurably to rewire the brains of those infants. Healthcare system isn't going to be able to address that by itself.
Well, Dr. Geiger, what's your prognosis and what are your observations about the current generation of students of the health professions and how they feel about going into primary care and the likelihood that they will?
Most of the predictions for the coming shortage of primary care practitioners, physicians at least, is in the range of high 30,000s or 40,000. And we know that simultaneously with Obamacare, there will be increased demand. We know that from what happened in Massachusetts with greatly expanded insurance coverage. There is very good evidence for what happens to medical students at present for a variety of reasons. Idealism is very high when people enter medical school. That's why they came in the main. And there's very good evidence that that declines sharply and steadily over the first 7 years of training. And there are at least two reasons for that. One is the enormous burden of debt that all medical students start to accumulate and find that an almost insupportable burden that drives them away from primary care and into procedure-based, higher-income, subspecialty practices. A second reason is a distorted reimbursement system, and that has got to change if we have to have any hope of solving this problem at all. Third, we are going to have to recruit increasingly from the pools that we know are likeliest to be interested in primary care, and even more are likeliest to undertake practice in underserved areas of really vulnerable and sick populations. What that really means is that we need to recruit from those very populations and establish the kinds of pathways that remove the barriers both of poverty and poverty of aspiration.
We're speaking today with Dr. H. Jack Geiger, who's considered a father of the modern community health center movement, is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine. Dr. Geiger, your activities in healthcare go far beyond the examination room. Been a founding member of Physicians for Human Rights, Physicians for Social Responsibilities, somebody who was there in the freedom marches in the South. Tell us about that relationship between health and poverty and your thoughts about the social responsibilities for this next generation of medical providers.
I came from that background of activism well before I developed an interest in medicine and decided to try to become a physician. And the answer came, obviously, that one has a responsibility as a physician to join or create the organizations that do that kind of work. One of the first of those was Physicians for Social Responsibility, which way back in the early 1960s, when our government, like many other governments, was trying to tell the population that nuclear war wouldn't be so bad if you just dug a shelter in your backyard, you'd probably be okay, of doing the first real analyses of the medical consequences of a thermonuclear war And that was followed during the Cold War by physicians doing what we called the bombing run, going city to city across the United States, getting on television, putting up a map of wherever we were, and saying, here's the bullseye that'll be created by a 1 megaton thermonuclear blast, just one. And it turned out to be a compelling contribution. In the same way, Physicians for Human Rights formed in 1986, and both of those organizations ended up sharing in the Nobel Prize for Peace. Physicians for Human Rights was organized in exactly the same way to bring the skills of physicians to the investigation and documentation of crimes against humanity, war crimes. Back in Mississippi, we started to address social determinants because they were so overwhelming. What is it that you do when you discover that people's primary source of water was to collect rainwater in old pesticide barrels? Mm-hmm. What is it that you need to do when you discover that people are literally trying to shoot squirrels or gather pecan nuts because mechanization has destroyed the sharecropper culture? People have virtually no income. Whenever we saw a child in such a family with infectious disease and malnutrition, we wrote prescriptions for food and arranged to have that family fill those prescriptions at local black grocery stores, which sent a bill to the community health center, which paid for it out of the pharmacy budget. And the governor of Mississippi screamed his worst fears had been realized. Soviet communism, he thought, had come to the Mississippi Delta. And he yelled at Washington, and our funders in Washington got very upset and came down and yelled at us and me and said, what did I think we were doing? And I said, what was wrong with it? And he said, well, a pharmacy and a health center is for drugs for the treatment of disease. And I said, the last time I looked in the book, the best therapy for malnutrition was food. And he went away. It is that spirit that still informs community health center and has to inform our whole approach to what we do. And there are many venues, both in voluntary non-governmental organizations, to do that.
Dr. Geiger, I know that you've lost none of your vision looking to the future and none of your passion for the future. And I think I've come to the conclusion that it's the case that every generation needs to discover some of this anew. And that was brought home recently when we had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Rishi Manchanda, who's written a new book, The Upstream Doctors, in which he calls for a new focus on social determinants and getting upstream to prevent illness and reduce their burden. With all the new incredible technology tools at our disposal today, do you foresee a new era in how we address those social determinants of health? And how do you think, when you just put your vision cap on, this generation of public health and primary care practitioners will be fighting them?
Well, we attracted recruits for physicians and nurses and others that had always wanted the opportunity to do this kind of work among vulnerable populations. For example, at the Buford Jasper Health Center in South Carolina, early on, they discovered that they were confronting a virtual epidemic of hypertension. And then they discovered that the reason was that people were drinking brackish surface water, their only source of supply, which had a monstrous salt content. So a major part of their work became installing water systems that gave people what most of the rest of society had, access to decent, clean, safe water. The way we have to do that now, I think, to be actively promoting collaboration with other segments of government and the private sector, that is, the housing authorities, the education authorities. We have high school-based community health centers that give us that opportunity. And so investments that we can make jointly with others, that we can make jointly with other agencies, both public and private, in education, housing, job training, environmental protection, are the way we have to start going after those problems now, rather than undertaking all of those burdens as primary responsibilities on our own. We are adding lawyers to the teams at community health centers, medical legal partnerships, college students through health leads, and we need to expand that pattern and to address not just palliative efforts, but structural efforts to change the distributions of opportunity in the society.
We've been speaking today with Dr. H. Jack Geiger, father of the community health center movement in this country and founding member of Physicians for Human Rights and Physicians for Social Responsibilities. You can find out more about his work by going to physiciansforhumanrights.org. Dr. Geiger, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare Today and making a difference for all Americans.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, some of our readers have asked us whether the healthcare law contains a hidden tax on hunting and fishing equipment. The answer is no. This rumor started spreading after Cabela's, a Nebraska sporting goods store, mistakenly charged some customers on January 1st for a medical excise tax. That's what it said on their receipts, and at least a few images of those receipts have been circulating on the internet. A spokesman for Cabela's told the Omaha World Herald that a glitch in the cash register system caused the error, that this glitch only happened on the one day and all customers were offered a refund. Now, the healthcare law does contain a 2.3% excise tax on certain medical devices. It isn't a direct tax on consumers. It's a tax on manufacturers and importers of medical devices. These are items typically used by medical professionals. And there's an exemption for things like eyeglasses, contact lenses, hearing aids, and devices generally purchased by the public for individual use. One viral email by an anonymous author claims that the IRS website says the tax would apply to items that include sport fishing equipment, tackle boxes, bows and quivers, and gas guzzler automobiles. But whoever wrote that email is wrong. Those are items that were already taxed, not by the healthcare law, and they were in a list of excise taxes in general. They're not subject to any new 2.3% medical device tax. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been taking a number of hits lately for attempting to ban everything from styrofoam packaging for takeout food to large sugary drinks in restaurants and city-run facilities. Dodging criticisms that he's practicing nanny politics, Bloomberg has nonetheless forged ahead. He cites his interest in not only improving the health of his New York City constituents, but in setting an example for other public officials to follow around the country. It's been 10 years since Mayor Bloomberg launched his first controversial ban, ending smoking in bars and restaurants throughout the city's five boroughs. The proposed Smoke-Free Air Act was met at the time with a hailstorm of criticism and dire warnings of lost business and tax revenue due to the ban. But at a recent gathering at a venerable old New York City watering hole, the Old Town Bar off Union Square, Bloomberg shared facts that bore out quite a different story. Since the ban went into effect, health officials estimate that 10,000 lives have been saved in reduced smoking rates and a dramatic reduction in exposure to secondhand smoke. And the restaurant and the bar owners, well, they have apparently seen the light as well. The mayor was flanked by Old Town's owner, Gerard Meager, who was one of the band's most vocal opponents at the time. Meager compared his tavern's receipts from before and after the ban and found his business actually increased by 20%. Turns out, once the ban was in place and the perennial blue haze of smoke was gone, people began to spend more on the restaurant food. Meager also touted another bonus, fewer cleaning bills. Smoking bans are now commonplace across the country. boding well for the health of those working in bars and restaurants as well as the patrons. A municipal smoking ban that not only improves the health and well-being of workers and patrons, but has turned out to be good for the business bottom line as well. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.